for the Reason Podcast. I'm Zach Weissmuller, coming to you in front of a live audience in Reason's Los Angeles headquarters, where I'm talking with Reason journalist Robbie Suave, author of the new book, Panic Attack, Young Radicals in the Age of Trump. Robbie, it is great to have you here in the LA office.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, thank you. So your book is largely an examination of the excesses of the what you call the intersectional left, and that's mostly and prominently on display on college campuses. It also delves into the identitarian right, but I would say it's mostly focused on the former. It seems like you visited a fair number of college campuses and protests in reporting out this book. It's a very well-reported book. So I'm curious, just to start, if you could give us some insight into your process. Walk us through the logistics of how you put this together.
Sure. You know, I've been writing about kind of the culture on college campuses for kind of a while now. And I think it was 2015 when really the national media started paying a lot more attention to the climate of censorship emerging on campuses that had been there a while. I mean, some people argue had been there all along and never went away. But these incidents were things like Nicholas Christakis at Yale, who was a dean who was yelled at by the students because his wife had said that they should be able to wear whatever Halloween costumes they want. And a small subset of student activists had rejected that. And they had said, no, Yale must be a emotional safe space. That is your job to provide that for us. So there were a couple things like that that attracted a lot of media attention. And eventually kind of was the push for an agent to come to me and say, you know, I've been reading your writing on this subject. It seems like you don't fit into the right or the left, which is true. As a, you know, a libertarian, I'm a more neutral arbiter of I obviously have an agenda of my own, but no kind of skin in the game between conservatives and progressives fighting. Mm. So he thought my perspective on this would be valid. So then I started putting together the book, visiting campuses, like you said, trying to engage the kind of students who were involved in the behavior that we've seen and that has been criticized, and to try to understand why they were choosing these tactics that I find concerning because they threaten some very fundamental libertarian principles that actually that historically have overlapped with the left, free mm-hmm. speech, due process, that kind of thing.
And so were you just hopping from campus to campus? I mean, what sort of events were you attending?
So I went to, for instance, I knew Charles Murray was going to come speak at the University of Michigan, which is where I graduated from. So I know the campus kind of well. So I thought that would be a good one to go to and see how he was received. This was after the infamous incident where he went to Middlebury and he was like actually attacked. Like physically attacked his debate partner, a liberal professor, where they put her like in a neck brace by, again, a subset of students. So I went to Michigan when he was there to see how they would greet him. And while there was no physical violence, there was the shouting down, the refusal to kind of listen to what he had to say. And then afterward, I went to where the student activists were and I talked to them about the event. I did so beforehand, too. And I did a lot of, you know, when I'd see if a student would write something in the student paper saying that we don't want someone like this to speak on campus, and I would email them and say, hey, can I interview you about your perspective on this? So I did a lot of engaging with the students, even when I couldn't necessarily be there in person.
And you mentioned that your particular vantage point was attractive to the publisher. And how do you think that affected the final product? It does have a sort of cool, detached feel to it, which is good.
Why, thank you, Zach.
Yeah. And there's these are just extremely hot button issues. And I do feel that this book, you're able to step back a little bit. How do you think that your vantage point as a 30-year-old libertarian affected the product?
So I hope, you know, that because I really feel my audience is sort of moderate liberals. I mean, I'm sure people on the right will like the book because they're, you know, concerned about many of these shutdowns, especially when they impact conservative speakers. But it's sort of a warning to people on the slight left who I have some common ground with on things like, I don't know, criminal justice reform, you know, things libertarians tend to agree with liberals on. And my concern is that the kind of the certain strain of leftist progressivism has hijacked these conversations and is using tactics that are just like ridiculously off-putting to most people and are very counterproductive and actually bring them into conflict with each other. Hmm. I mean, the book is a chronicle of infighting because of their ideologies that make them like battle each other over some very fringe stuff that is interesting and fun to, you know, it's easy to make fun of, but it is something that should be counseled against because it's like has a negative effect on social change for society.
And the ideology that you are talking about in this book, you identify as intersectionality. What is that?
Sure. So intersectionality, it's impossible for me to overstate its importance to the modern left. I've described it as the operating system for progressive activism. So intersectionality comes from a sociologist named Kimberly Crenshaw, who coined the term in the late 1980s. It was her way of describing the joint impact of racism and sexism. So a black woman languishes under more oppression, two different kinds of oppression, versus just black people and just women. And she was actually referring to a specific lawsuit against, I believe it was against General Motors. It was against a car company in which black women were suing the company for saying they had been discriminated against because the company had a policy of firing the most recently hired employees. And they were saying, well, that's often black women because the Civil Rights Act didn't before it existed. They didn't have to hire us, so now they've more recently started hiring us. So of course, we're the first people hired. So they were saying this policy violates the Civil Rights Act. But and the court said, but you don't get you're protected because for racial reasons and for gender-based reasons, but not for like the cumulative effect of those. Which it's a very interesting court case. And so my beef with intersectionality is not the theory itself. I mean, I think people, black women do suffer from, not all of them, but historically, the having both of those factors working against you, certainly there has been joint oppression. But the kind of adherence of the intersectional framework, I think, have added so many other categories of oppression. Again, oftentimes things that are valid related to gender identity, orientation, etc. But they're also saying that everyone must oppose all of these things with equal fervor. And if you're not sufficiently worked up about all of them, we don't want you in our coalition. This manifested itself over and over again when I talked to students for the book. A bunch of them told me that they had wanted nothing to do with the Women's March, which took place right after Trump's the day after Trump's inauguration. You know, hundreds of thousands of people showed up to this thing in D.C. It was the most well-attended protest since the Vietnam War, and they said, no, we hated it. It was terrible. Why? Because it was not led by a coalition of the most oppressed. The people organizing it were not black and women and trans people and so on and so forth. They wanted only the most oppressed victims could have authority to address these issues, according to the sort of intersectional activists, which very self-defeating, I think, if that's what you're operating off of.
There's the ways we've seen this manifest on college campuses has been the rise of things like trigger warnings, safe spaces, microaggressions. I think a lot of people are familiar with all these terms at this point, where that all seems to be couched in a sort of idea of safety, like you're aggressing against me with your words, you're triggering me into some sort of PTSD-like state. Where did that idea come from? Is that related to intersectionality?
So I think it's a different phenomenon, but the intersection of the two is something that has made campus a very kind of maddening and baffling place for observers of higher ed culture. I mean, you have 100 campuses. At more than that, at least 100, have bias reporting systems designed around intersectionality. So if you see something, say something, report, you're supposed to report if you see incidents of oppression, not even illegal sort of oppression, just saying microaggressions, small, slight harms for reasons of identity, for reasons of race. Or sex, or orientation, or gender, or disability status, or religion, or age, or size. There is sizism. That is one on the tier of intersectional-based oppressions. And these things are cataloged and reported on the campuses. So if there's this immense bureaucracy, and of course all of these universities have grown their administrative states by an unimaginable factor. You know, professors, their ranks have not increased. Their salaries have not really increased. Meanwhile, there are, 10 senior vice president of inclusion and sustainable diversity, and they're all making like $150K. No exaggeration. This is at like every major university. And so these people's part of their job is to make the students feel comfortable and to handle and adjudicate all these matters. So eventually it's going to be, if there is this tool, right, you're going to see yourself as someone who deserves this extra level of comfort and safety that the apparatus of the university has to provide for you. So their safetyism, it's difficult to trace exactly and know for sure where that comes from. Yeah, John Haidt and Greg Lukianoff have written a book, The Coddling of the American Mind. They think a lot of what our colleague at Reason, Lenore Skenazy, talks about, helicopter parenting, things like that, have contributed to kind of over-parenting, over-safety vibes among young people. And I think that's partly true. But part of it is just that, I mean, you have these student activists who have, again, these tools on campus, the reason to see themselves as victims because there are these structures that telling them to see themselves like that. Not all students, not most students, but a small number, a tiny number of radicals have weaponized these processes to the detriment of free speech.
And if there – what is the consequence of that? Because the students seem to want to be protected. They want safe spaces. They want microaggressions policies. What are the negative consequences of that in your mind?
I mean, there are new examples every week. And an example I'm very worked up about right now that actually isn't in the book because it happened after the due date at Harvard University, the most prestigious institution of education in our country. There's a professor named Ron Sullivan, who's a law professor there and also a faculty dean of one of the residential colleges. And he's a progressive expert on criminal justice issues. He advised Senator Obama before Obama was president. He's helped free lots of wrongly incarcerated people. He as a defense attorney, he's represented controversial and indeed despicable people, because that's how our system works, right? We believe even, the people responsible for the Boston Massacre deserve representation. That was the John Adams view, who represented them. So he's represented, I think, Aaron Hernandez, a football player accused of murder. He's represented accused terrorists. This has never been a problem for the left before, but he had decided to represent Harvey Weinstein. Yeah. So about 50 students on campus staged a protest saying that Harvard is now an unsafe place for women because he is representing Harvey Weinstein. The students won. Harvard launched an investigation of Ron Sullivan, and they fired him as faculty dean. They caved 100% to, again, this not everyone on campus was demanding this. It was 50 students, but they got their way because these students have a view that safety encompasses them feeling uncomfortable on an emotional level. And that's a major theme of the book. When I talk to the students about their tactics, like at Michigan, I talked to one, don't you think you shouting down Charles Murray to a neutral observer, that person would be more sympathetic to Charles Murray watching you, scream obscenities at him? Whereas if maybe they would disagree if they had to hear what he was going to say, but because of what you're doing, he seems more sympathetic. And they kind of just said, but if he speaks and then he makes marginalized people on the campus feel uncomfortable, then it compromises their safety. So I'm not interested your theoretical argument for why this is would be influential might be right, but we're literally concerned about safety.
Yeah.
And thus their tactics are a form of self-defense because they include words on the same spectrum as violence.
Yeah, and their tactics at times have escalated into violence. I mean, even in the Murray example, you write in the book that Murray and the person he was debating, I guess, were physically assaulted on their way out. You visited UC Berkeley, where the provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos gave a speech and all hell broke loose. People were throwing Molotov cocktails and barricades. I actually visited that campus a year after for Reason TV to talk to students, and they were ambivalent about it. They blamed some of it on they blamed most of it on Antifa. They said we're not affiliated with the student body, but at the same time, they seem to be making similar arguments that this can be justified as an act of self-defense. So what were the attitudes you encountered about specifically political violence?
Right. So it remains the case that only the very, very far left endorses political violence. Only your Antifa type people. And they do indeed, because they, you know, so my book is broken into chapters, each chapter being about a category of activism. These are all related to some degree. It's just the way I organize the book. So one of them is about sort of political activism and Antifa. And these people come from, you know, a long political tradition dating back to Europe in the 1930s. They are explicitly an illiberal ethos. They do not believe that, you know, we should give equal rights to people who hate us, to people who have bad right-wing fascist ideas. We should explicitly not give those people rights. This is their kind of intellectual sort of one of their intellectual figures is Marcuse, Herbert Marcuse, mm-hmm. The influential New Left thinker of the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm. Critical theory.
Right. Critical theory. Who argued for repressive tolerance we can't be so tolerant that we let intolerant people reorder our society so that there's no tolerance.
Right.
And he very much wrote kind of a handbook for it might be justified to not have right-wing views expressed in the media or in our schools. So it was explicitly not a classically liberal First Amendment liberal outlook. And that is the perspective that the Antifa people bring to all this. I think it also has a long history of just totally backfiring. There are examples, even like going back a long way, of fascist groups actually recruiting more effectively because newspapers had to write about their groups if there was like a violent confrontation with the anti-fascists. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they were not in the news, so no one would know about these groups. Like, so fascist sympathetic people wouldn't know about the group to go join it. But if there was a clash, then they go, oh, that's the group. That's how I join it. Richard Nixon, there's a memo he got when he was president. One of his advisors said to expect a lot of violence on campuses in the coming year, and he just wrote back, "Good," because he thought it turns people away from the kind of activism they represent. It makes them more sympathetic to the kind of law and order society he was in favor of.
Hmm. The rationale I've also seen is, you know, you're talking a lot about tactics, and they would say that their tactics have been somewhat effective in that they've raised the cost for universities of allowing these people. It costs, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars now to provide security for some of these controversial speakers. Some folks on the alt-right have basically said they've stopped appearing because Antifa has made the cost too high. So how do you respond to the argument that, you know, this stuff does work, at least in the short term, I guess, and I guess more broadly that, you know, maybe deplatforming in a sense can work?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complicated question. Some of it worked in some cases. I think it's wrong to say that Milo specifically was brought down by mm-hmm. deplatforming, because when it was just people protesting him, even violently, again, he ate that up. That was great.
Yeah.
Because he didn't have anything really interesting to talk about anyway. It was better, yeah. It was better if they would interrupt him, scream things, he would plead martyr. That was his whole shtick. Yeah. I mean, people were inviting him for that reason. The college Republicans, there's a group at Stanford who had like admitted, there was a National Review article where someone who I think was in that club said, we discussed who we were going to invite, and then we're like, let's invite Milo. The left will hate it. They'll protest it. Or, you know, it's totally a publicity thing. So I think that was all just to finish my. Yeah, so I think sure. That was all good for him. To some degree, he was undone not by shielding, not by censoring what he had to say, but by just letting people learn what he had to say. I mean, what he had said in his emails came out. People exposed really horrible things he had said, and then he was disinvited from some things. So it that did play a role. But learning more about him caused people to turn against him. Just shouting him down, as they did at campuses, did not and would never have, in my opinion.
Yeah. What do you think of these conservative groups basically using figures like Milo, admitting we're just trolling the left in a way?
Yeah. I mean, it's really pretty gross. I mean, they have. This book is mostly a story about the left, because the left has a lot of power on college campuses suddenly, and that was the phenomenon I was interested in exploring. But certainly, the right has responded to and sort of its intellectual quality has worsened in response, kind of over the time period I was writing this. The students, the conservative activist students, just became more and more interested again in. You know, to trigger the libs. That's a joke. Everybody has heard that now. To own the libs.
Yeah.
But it's a joke. But that really has been to some degree their operating strategy.
Yeah.
You know, even someone like Charles Murray, who is thoughtful. I don't always agree with him, but he's certainly thoughtful and worth inviting. But it's like he was their go-to person because they knew he was going to get attacked. There is a wealth of other conservative people who maybe there would be no protest and there would actually be discussion. And it seemed like a lot of them were less interested in having those people. Obviously, it's a big country. There's tons of universities. It's also the case that there's plenty of colleges where they invited someone and we never heard about it because there was no protest and everything was fine. So I'm certainly not trying to say that this always happens or this happens most of the time. I'm not trying to worry people into thinking that there's no such thing as free speech anywhere on campus. But it is a problem at some of our most elite institutions, like Harvard, Yale, Reed, Oberlin, the UC system, Michigan, where I went to, there have been incidents that I think should worry us, even if it doesn't, even if I would counsel us from not going to full blown, oh my God, it's the most serious crisis ever, or something like that.
If there's this ongoing sort of tribal warfare between the intersectional left and people on the right who want to own them, where do libertarians stand in that, or where should they stand in this tribal war?
That's a good question. I mean, we stand in with neither side, right? No, we are not. We are not a identity-based movement, right? Mm-hmm. We believe in individual liberty, individual rights, that your meaning sort of – that all people, by virtue of being individuals, have rights. And so I think we're also just wary in general of, like, joining big groups.
Yeah.
Even sometimes when I'm with other libertarians, I go, well, are you really a libertarian? You're this kind of libertarian. I'm that kind of libertarian. Let's divide. Which is sometimes this is why we don't – this is why, despite what Tucker Carlson said yesterday, we don't have all that much political power. I don't know if the audience heard he had a Tucker Carlson, the Fox News host, had a talk about how libertarian DC is concentrated with sort of like libertarian power, which is true in the narrow sense that I do think people in DC are more socially liberal and more for free markets and open borders than the rest of the country. But obviously, like, Cato is not running the government right now.
Yeah, there
much to our detriment.
Yeah, there has been this sort of strange phenomenon or resurgence on the social conservative right recently. There was a sort of freak out about a drag queen drag queens reading to children at a library that inspired one writer to say, you know, it's time for conservatives to bring down the fist and restore the social order.
Yeah.
We already know that the intersectional left hates us. So what do we do in this situation?
Of course, and again, this is an example of horseshoe theory where the two most extremes do meet, because the right has this drag queens are talking to our children freak out, but also the left, some members of the intersectional left also hate drag queens because you're mocking, it's mocking identity, and that should not be permitted. Yeah. They take identity very seriously. There's actually in one of my chapters about gender-related issues and transgender-related activism, there's a tension between, RuPaul is this, it has a show, probably many of you have seen it, about drag queens, and he sort of got canceled very briefly. The left came for him because he said that he would not want a trans person, a person who is a man who's transitioning to female, to be on the show, because then it would no longer be a man dressed in woman's clothes. It would be a woman. Mm. And that their whole point is to like mock identity, and these rigorous categories of identity that like the left loves is not where he wants his show to be. And he got Vox freaked out at him about that.
It's
a little off topic,
it's on topic in a way, because this seems to be strangely one of the most salient issues for both the intersectional left and the right in some ways, at least the socially conservative right, this debate over transgender rights. And you spend considerable time breaking that debate down. It obviously has high stakes for actual transgender people, but it seems to have taken on a symbolic value for both sides in the culture war. What are the underlying issues that are at stake in this debate?
Yeah, I mean, there's a illiberal streak in some of the activism on trans issues. Again, I'm not a social conservative, so I'm not a Ben Shapiro saying that there's something not right about transgender people or that they shouldn't transition. I don't agree with any of that. But the activist community around those issues do tend to fight with even like very sort of mainstream left of center journalists who write about these issues. Jesse Singel is one. Katie Herzog is another. These are people who are definitely liberals or people on the left, far more on the left than you or I are, who have just written about these issues, and again, from a very socially liberal point of view, mm-hmm. that they have drawn, like Katie Herzog, I think she lives in Seattle, like she had people like burning copies of The Stranger, which is, again, that's the far left sex, Dan Savage is the editor of it, he's a gay sex columnist. A gay man who writes about sex issues. I phrased that badly. And they're burning copies of this because she just pointed out that some people, not a lot, but some people who transition regret doing so and transition back. That mm-hmm. Not all, not most.
Yeah.
And people should be able to do whatever, this is a libertarian thing. People should be able to do whatever they want with their own bodies. But she just questioned whether this was the right choice for everyone.
Yeah.
And they acted like she was Hitler. And they've done the same, not the broader community, just the activists around these issues. And it's honestly some like deeply crazy stuff, and that's in the book.
Yeah, and I actually pulled a quote that's somewhat related to this that I want to read about this topic in particular. And you say, in order to suss out the truly gender dysphoric, fairly invasive psychological questioning is probably necessary, which runs counter to the activist desires. Young people increasingly experimenting with gender fluidity and living outside the gender binary are in some sense contributing to the confusion here. They may seem dysphoric to the casual eye, but they are really just interested in transgressing gender norms, not in changing their underlying sex. But pointing out this tension does not make one a proper intersectional ally. I mean, if we fail to talk honestly about those sort of tensions between transgressive experimentation, which is really part and parcel of adolescence in some ways, and are immediately jumping into affirming an identity, what effects do you think that kind of, and it can go beyond the trans debate, but kind of this idea that everything must immediately be categorized and identities must be kind of set in stone, What are the broader implications on society there?
Yeah, and that it must be clinical. It must be diagnosable. It must be, I mean, you have, to take it back to the students, I mean, you have students, and I think the destigmatization around mental health is good. People, you know, who have mental struggles are talking openly about them far more than ever before. But there is a, and I want to be careful how I talk about it because it, I want to be sensitive to people who do have mental health issues. Mm-hmm. But there are, I've talked to professors who tell me that every student in their classroom says they suffer from PTSD. Every student at a very prestigious liberal arts college has a PTSD issue. And thus, you can't give me negative feedback on my in-class performance. And I need another week to do the exam. And I'm not turning, I mean... There are students weaponizing our greater sensitivity for mental health issues to sort of just get out of doing their homework. I interviewed for the book a theater professor who couldn't – who she just gave up in frustration trying to say anything to her students. Every single one of them said – and if you had a – so she was teaching acting. So she said if you had – men playing male roles, men playing female roles. If you no matter which way you did it, someone said you had failed some test of intersectionality. And even if they were conflicting demands, someone pushing someone, like on the like a light pushing on the soldier on the shoulder. Someone came to see her after class and said, "You just performed a sexual assault, and you've just re-traumatized everyone in the classroom." I mean, this is and by the way, this professor who I spoke with said she taught at a less privileged college before she went to teach these students, where many of her students were like soldiers who had just come back from Iraq, and none of them had PTSD issues. I mean, you know, come on. Yeah. I visited Arizona State University for some research for the book. I've described it this way before, but it beautiful campus. The sun is shining. Like, the student body continues to win, like, most attractive student body in the country every year. Like, it's a nice place to live. And there is a sign every 5 feet that says, "Should you visit the counseling center? Are you? Did you remember to breathe today? Breathe. I mean, there can be a. I think there is almost in some cases maybe an encouragement to see yourself as having some mental struggle, and that actually plays into the intersectionality-based hierarchy. Because if you're a very progressive, you know, cis white straight male, so you don't languish under any of the categories, so you have no authority when you discuss with other activists, because according to intersectionality, only victims themselves are the experts on these issues. We must all feel fall silent and listen to them, but we also can't just expect them to speak for themselves either, so it's actually ends up being completely contradictory. But so if you don't have any source of oppression, well, mental health would be a source, and that's an easier one to I'm not saying people are making it up, but it would be an easier one to make up than being like not the race you are, right? You can't, if you're white, you can't pretend to not be white. Rachel Dolezal aside, which actually I read a little bit about her in this book because I don't know, I find it, I was not as outraged by this is, I guess, a controversial opinion, but race is a more made up category than gender, actually, or sex and gender. Yeah. Sex and gender is based in at least some biological reality. I mean, I am fine with these categories being mutable, but race is just like totally made up.
Yeah.
So it was funny that
Rachel Dolezal has a point. That's what you're saying.
Well, I'm saying it was not to me so totally ridiculous that she would identify with the culture of another race or something.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, we must embrace, and you are shunned as like a Nazi if you don't embrace the idea of transgenderism. But like transracialism was unthinkable for some reason. I found that a little weird. Maybe that's just me.
Well, your willingness to cover these topics, some might even say eagerness, have made you a bit of a lightning rod yourself. And I want to give you the chance to reply to some of your critics directly. I'm just going to run down a quick list here.
Oh, boy.
And you can respond to any or all
Need
of them.
Need another drink.
Or just pass. Yeah, someone, please. In 2014, Rolling Stone reported on a horrific gang rape that had allegedly occurred at a frat party on the University of Virginia campus. And you were one of the first journalists to question the details of that story. A Jezebel writer ran a headline reading, "Is the UVA rape story a giant hoax?" asks idiot, that idiot being you. Of course, your skepticism did turn out to be warranted, and the article was retracted because of major holes in the story and insufficient evidence, and Rolling Stone actually ended up paying a major settlement to the fraternity in question. This year, a video clip went viral that many interpreted as a MAGA hat-wearing teen boys getting in the face of an elderly Native American gentleman. You actually watched the whole video and pointed out that it was a little more complicated and that the teens hadn't actually been the ones to initiate the confrontation. And many large media outlets sort of begrudgingly started acknowledging this. Bob Garfield, host of WNYC's On the Media, recounted it and described you as a contrarian provocateur. A Deadspin writer called you a professional contrarian. You recently testified in front of a House committee about hate crimes, expressing skepticism about a mild spike in the hate crime statistics, which you argued could be attributed to simply more police precincts documenting hate crimes than had in previous years. And for this, Huffington Post reporter Andy Campbell called you a bad faith witness who denied that hate and white supremacy pose a threat at all. Yeah, so I'll just let you pick any or all of those responses.
Yeah, the Huffington Post guy said I denied that white supremacy poses any threat at all, but like quoted me later in the article saying that I abhor white supremacy and it's very bad and it's terrible to the extent that it exists. That some of these, so that one was such a, I think, unfair mischaracterization of what I said that it's kind of, it was like the hit piece you want to be written about you because yeah. Then everyone comes to your defense because it was so unfair. And it was just, you know, it bore no resemblance to the what actually happened. So I was testifying before Congress on hate crimes. I was brought, the Republicans had invited me to kind of counsel that let's not go overboard in pretending that hate crimes are worse than they've ever been. I'm not sure the evidence shows that. Actually, the witnesses who had been brought by the Democrats didn't even really fundamentally disagree with that. We had what I thought was a pretty nuanced discussion about the trade-offs between policing hate and civil liberties. And it was fine. I spoke with Susan Bro was there, who is the mother of the woman who died in Charlottesville, who was killed by white supremacists at Charlottesville. And, you know, the Huffington Post characterized it as how insulting to her that she had to sit next to this denier of white supremacy. Mm-hmm. But we actually had like a great conversation where she said her view was probably somewhere between the other panelists and mine. And she said she was going to check out Reason Magazine. So like it was so we had a very. Thank you. So it bore no resemblance to that. So I'm not a provocateur whatsoever. I contrarian may be fair because sometimes the media gets major stories wrong. Covington and Rolling Stone are two examples of those. And I try to call them out when I think they get it wrong. I think when they get Trump-related things wrong, even though I'm not a fan of Trump at all, I say so. I think that's hard and confusing in the moment we're in because everything is Team Trump or Team Media. Mm-hmm. And that's as much Trump's fault as anyone because he has positioned the media as the opposition party. And then many in the media have enjoyed that being in that position. So the media is not seen as referees because they're the other team. Yeah. So it's sometimes hard to talk about. So the Rolling Stone thing was before, well before Trump. I bet if it had happened now, you would have people. So every in the Rolling Stone event, everybody had to pretty much admit that she totally made this up. That Jackie was not sexually assaulted. The person she accused did not exist. Text messages sent from him to her friends were sent by Jackie. It was a catfishing thing. There was like an enormous evidence that she practiced deception to like a really like sociopathic degree. Mm. If this had happened today, there would be. They're just like the Covington thing. There would be people on the left saying, no, we know what we know. We believe her. You know, mm-hmm. We know what she said. You know, we believe victims. If it was in the wake of the Me Too movement, which is what you saw with Covington, even though it was just it was so in just obvious to me after you watched the whole video that these kids were not that they had been cheering. to drown out this hate, black nationalist hate group. And they were doing that before the Native American man showed up. And then he approached them like they were the bad guys in this encounter, even though it was clearly like the crazy like Nation of Islam cult type group that had been yelling obscenities at them and threatening them. And then he mischaracterized the Native American man, just totally misrepresented what happened. So that is so obvious after you watch the greater clip. But you had I was baffled and truly disheartened by people in the media just clinging to their initial narrative there.
So it's your contention then that since the Rolling Stone article in 2014, it's actually become more difficult to be a skeptic of a kind of prevailing media narrative.
Well, and it's become more difficult to be a skeptic without being associated with Trumpism. If you're being skeptical of criticisms of things that, and you know, I mean, the Covington kids were wearing MAGA hats, so they were seen as part of Team Trump. So then it's like, I must be some kind of deranged Trump supporter if I'm defending them. And then it goes the other way, right? Because then the Trump administration wants to make these kids heroes for the cause of Trumpism. Yeah. Their lawyers are suing. It's a very sort of shaky case to me on free speech grounds. It's unlike the Rolling Stone lawsuits, which were very – I mean, some libertarians maybe don't believe there should be libel law at all. But if you think there is libel law, this was like very clearly they were right to say that Rolling Stone, what they did was just like absolutely – In violation of that. The thing against the Covington kids is not clearly libel at all. Eugene Volokh agree. I talked to him about it. He's the First Amendment scholar we libertarians love and rely on. But you have them, you know, like so it's a Trump versus media thing, yeah. and they've really kind of weaponized the kids for a pro-Trump cause. Yeah. That's frustrating to me. So it's just hard to talk about any of these issues and not lump them into, well, how does this serve Trump or how does this hurt him?
Yeah. So I want to finish up by kind of talking about that symbiotic relationship that seems to exist between the intersectional left and portions of the right. We already talked about the kind of impulse to own the libs, but on the kind of more disturbing side of things, there's the alt-right. And you talked with Richard Spencer for this book, who was one of the people who coined that term. What insight did talking with Spencer give you about the relationship between the alt-right and the intersectional left, the interplay between those two?
So it was interesting. Spencer himself, and just speaking for himself, had some, I would describe it as some degree of fondness or admiration for the left, mm-hmm. because he agrees with an identity-based framework.
Right.
He does not believe in individual rights. He doesn't think there's any such thing. Your rights come from your membership in a racial category. He wants a welfare state for white people. That's like explicitly what he wants. That's not that he wouldn't deny that. So he had some kind of admiration for the more identity-based leftism, and wants to do a similar, obviously in a much more horrifying way. He wants to, you know, banish members of other races from the country, and that's not, you know, and then other people in his coalition had different origin story. It's funny that, you know, libertarians get blamed for, they say there's an alt libertarian to alt right pipeline, which there are libertarians who became members of the alt-right,
yeah.
but there are also just conservatives who became members of the alt-right. Mm-hmm. There are leftists who became members of the alt-right. There's another Occupy Wall Street people whose, you know, Occupy Wall Street's criticism was of the major financial institutions. And there's a perception that, that's Jewish people control them, and the anti-Semitism is in the alt. So there's a horseshoe kind of anti-Semitism between the far left and the far right. There are people in the movement who are just sort of lonely and desperate, who would have joined any cult that they happened across. They could have ended up, you know, in any sort of like a like weird like guru kind of thing, or, you know, on a farm somewhere, or like the leftover. If anyone watches HBO's Leftovers, yeah. like they would have been in the white garb smoking the cigarettes.
Well, at least they would have kept their mouths shut.
Yeah. And so that's another category of people who join the alt-right. And then I think there are some people who it's a reaction to the left to some degree, to the whatever you want to call it, political correctness run amok or something. Which is not a defense of them joining the alt-right, obviously. If you get mad at the left and then like become a racist, that's on you.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there was a great story in a Washingtonian just 2 or 3 weeks ago about this 14-year-old kid who went through a sort of Kafka-esque sexual harassment hearing in his eighth grade. It would just your heart would break for what they put this kid through. He'd told a joke that was overheard and misinterpreted, and his principal told him he was going to go to jail for this, and they just they fucked this kid up so badly. Mm. And he finds online that there's this group of people who blame feminists and Jewish people and other people have faced what he faced, and you're not alone. And there's a trolling, making fun of the left kind of group, and he gradually more and more fell into the alt-right and was subsumed by it. And then the thing that broke him out of it, which has interesting implications for my more don't shut these people down agenda, is that when he actually went to a rally, an alt-right rally, and he met these people in person, he found them to be so pathetic and whiny and contradictory that he renounced the alt-right, and this was just a passing phase for him. Which is trying to shield him from these people would not have been the solution. Just kind of letting these things be aired. Sunshine is the best disinfectant.
And for those libertarians that you mentioned, there is a contingent who have been pulled to the right and even into the alt-right, partially as a reaction against the excesses of the intersectional left. I mean, what would you say to people who have felt that pull other than, don't stop, walk away?
I mean, I think some people were passing through libertarianism on their way to the most just out there thing. And for a while, libertarianism was the most out there thing. I think when Ron Paul really made a splash and he had a point of view that was just so different than anything else out there. And then some of them moved straight past that. I mean, I interviewed Christopher Cantwell for this book, who is a well-known...
the crying Nazi.
Now he's known as the crying Nazi. But before that, he was an anarcho-capitalist who would watch the cops. He had an anti-cop thing. So I talked to him about his turn to the alt-right, and he's so far on the alt-right now, and it was basically because a cop was nice to him once. He had a police encounter where the police were just really respectful toward him, and he had a gun out, and it could have in his thinking it would have ended with the police just gunning him down on sight, and instead they were really nice to him and let him go. And then he decided, so maybe authoritarianism is not that bad. And so what do you do with that? I mean, that's just a quirk of fate that is what led him to the alt-right.
Based on what you learned researching and reporting for this book, where do you think our politics are likely to go from here? And thinking optimistically, how do you hope things change, or where do you hope things go from here?
So part of the reason that I am so mildly concerned about the influence of the intersectional left, even though they are, again, a fringe, there's not very many of them. They do not have the numbers. This is not a generational condemnation. Not all people, or not even most young people, are like this. However, it only takes one person who is like this on the campus, or in your company, or working for your social media firm, or at your magazine, who is going to sort of weaponize harassment law in a way that just destroys the culture of allowing uncomfortable speech to take place. So I'm worried, we now have, this is a random example, but the young adult novel community, there are authors who write young adult novels who are canceling their novels because two or three woke scold people said there was something problematic somewhere in the book, even if their criticism is completely uninformed. There was one book, I think it was called Blood Air, and again, this is a fantasy book for kids about Russian magicians or something like that, and there's an underclass of slaves in the book, and one of these woke intersectional reviewers said, well, how dare you appropriate an American story, the American story of slavery, for a novel set in Russia, as if there had been no slavery in Russia. Yeah. The American South is the only place in the world that ever had slavery. I mean, that is a very uninformed criticism. That book, she pulled it. She pulled her book, she sanitized it, and now I guess it's going to come out with, so Ray Bradbury said there is more than one way to burn a book. It's this kind of self self-censorship in the face of kind of mob-like behavior that I worry is going to negatively affect our culture, that we're already seeing that at some media companies, firms that are more likely to hire young people. Again, not because all young people are going to do this, but because there are a few squeaky wheels are being paid attention to.
Is there any way out of this, or are we just headed straight for bonfires full of young adult novels?
Yeah, no, we're just doomed.
Yeah.
I don't see any reason why this would come. The things I'm concerned about would just suddenly end of their own accord. I think they're likely to continue getting worse as these people increasingly move off of campuses, unless there is a sustained effort to really push back on them. There has been, to some degree, on campuses. I think last year was maybe a down year for some of the shutdowns, or at least I thought that until the Ron Sullivan thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been administrators who have challenged students, even other students. I mean, the people who want to like shut down or kill or whatever Charles Murray will, if they feel like they've lost the room, if the other students stand up and say, "Shut up, I want to hear him," they back down.
Hmm.
But it's when they think they have like an informal power that no one's going to criticize them, that's when they get away with this. I guess I'll conclude with this. At the Charles Murray event I was at in Michigan, and I keep returning to it because it was such a good like example of the thing I'm talking about. The mob briefly fell silent when a student who was a minority, I think a Arabian minority, you know, stood up and said, "Well, I don't think I agree with Charles Murray, but I'm here to hear what he actually has to say." And then they had to you know kind of change what their plan was for the rest of the event. So I think challenging some of these people can work, has worked in some situations. I would like to see more of that, but for the time being, we may be dealing with your young adult novels will be harder to read.
All right, well, let's go get a drink. The book is Panic Attack, Young Radicals in the Age of Trump. It is available for pre-order now on Amazon, so go ahead and line up and get it. Robbie Suave, thanks for talking to me.
My pleasure. Thank you.